All right, we all set?
Sounds good.
All right, welcome back to the Intervention Podcast. We've got the full gang here today. Levi and Stevie are here with me, and we're here on December 28th, just after Christmas for those who celebrate, and on the heels of another glorious year barreling down towards 2024. So guys, how was your holiday?
Pretty good. I don't know. Had a house full of people, so it wasn't as relaxing as I hoped, but it was good.
I spent it in the very heart of the empire, our nation's capital, Washington, D.C.
Down to the swamp, were you?
Yeah, it was great. Actually, it was really nice. We got to walk around the whole mall. It was the only thing open, and not a single bathroom was open, so there were people urinating all over our nation's capital.
That's
really
proper.
A beautiful sight.
I don't blame them. I saw an article the other day that apparently the swamp is returning. Like, all of the drainage that they put in to actually build up the city over all these wetlands, I guess it's starting to deteriorate and the water's starting to flow back in. So, like, I guess to the swamp ye shall return. So we'll see. But it seems like a fitting kind of end as we enter, hopefully, the end of the empire. But
now we'll get Trump back in there and he can drain the swamp again.
Just like he did the first time, right? He didn't add any more snakes or just recycle the same people that have been there for a long time.
No, we just got mustache guy back, but yeah. He was only in there for 30 days or 40 days.
And then we got CIA guy, right? Was that the order of operations there?
Oh, right. Elliot Abrams. Did he come in before or after?
I'm talking about, what's
you
that other?
You talking about Bolton?
We were talking about Bolton to start with, and then who was the other guy, though? The CIA guy, the fat guy.
The fat guy? Geez, I don't know. I guess I lost track of all the guys that he let back into the government.
What are, like, the crazy right-winger maniacs that support Trump going to think when he just picks Haley as his vice president?
The same thing they think about everything else.
Yeah,
she's not much at all.
Of a sudden not going to be a neocon. She'll be MAGA then.
Yeah,
I guess the same thing that the Biden people thought as soon as he picked Kamala Harris as his vice president.
Yeah, whatever narrative we need at the moment, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Either way, I'm sure it'll be the most important election of our lives.
Yeah,
I was in a swamp of a different kind, out in Long Island. I guess one of the concerning things to me was that Palestine didn't come up that much, which I was kind of anticipating some hostile conversations, but it was almost disappointing that it didn't come. Well, no, it was definitely disappointing that it didn't really come up at all, which, I mean, I kind of get it. It's like people aren't thinking about it if they're of a certain type, which I don't want to speak categorically, but there's a lot of petty bourgeois ideology out on that island. But there was, you know, so that was a little bit disappointing that didn't come up at all. I did, driving through one town, I did see a sign calling for a ceasefire. It looked like somebody had done a banner drop and just left it in some park. So that was kind of encouraging, but less on top of mind as I guess I was hoping for.
Yeah, we were kind of surprised walking around DC that we didn't see any protests of really any stripe. We saw one guy holding a stop the genocide in Gaza placard, but he was just alone on a corner. It was kind of surreal how little people seemed to acknowledge him as well.
I guess it was interesting. I mean, I was around my side of the family, really, so pretty much just like normie, maybe left of center, but pretty centered lib. But my dad's probably a little more left than lib. But anyway, all in support of Palestine, basically everyone that we spent the time with, which was good. But at the same time, like, petrified that Trump's going to win again and, like, kind of blind to the fact that he probably will win again. Just, like, in disbelief when I said, well, he's definitely going to win. And then also just, like, shocked that I don't think much would change if he won. They're like, but Biden's done a pretty good job. I'm like, okay, whatever.
I guess apart from the genocide, I mean,
yeah.
What are they talking about? What has he done such a great job
on? I think they're talking about domestically. I don't know what they're talking about. That's the point. But they just think he's done not that bad of a job domestically. I'm like, okay, that's what you think. And then Nick met a couple of them, and we kind of, I don't know. I think we were both a little, we held back a lot when we were, it was a nice, we had a nice chat and nice conversation, but we didn't really push anything. But I think they were, you know, I think we both made some points, like, you know, if Biden had done anything to help people in this country, he would win easily, but he hasn't, so he won't.
Yeah. And again, that's setting Palestine aside. Like, before what's going on, he hadn't done anything. I think the only point that I remember making was just that the rhetoric is different, which is all it really comes down to, I think, between Biden and Trump. And there is a level, I don't want to go all lib now, but I think there is a level where some of that rhetoric does impact, I guess, to some extent. Like, I think you can correlate a rise in Asian hate crimes when Trump was in the office just because of how disgusting he spoke about Asians. But I mean, again, Biden is just as anti-China. And there's no room for any kind of nuance or excusing language at all when you're sending bombs to bomb people in a concentration camp. I mean, so I said, let's set it aside, but I ultimately cannot. And like, right. Again, like on the economy, like they're telling us it's okay, but where's my student loan forgiveness? A lot of people still can't buy a house for a decent price. Interest rates are through the roof. Minimum wage is still very low. Like, I mean, what is he delivered on?
Yeah. I mean, how many government bucks have we gotten from Trump at this point in his presidency? I mean, people were getting record amounts of unemployed compensation.
Yeah. I mean, just in the stimulus check area alone, Trump's up on him by $600 still, I think.
Oh, we miss him, guys. I mean, there are, again, setting aside Palestine, which it's not really worth setting aside, but even if you were going to, I think the few things that I remember saying positively about Biden since the beginning are that he got us out of Afghanistan, more or less, which he's enriled us in two more wars since. So that's a wash. He's making some changes around the margins. He's appointing more sympathetic left-ish judges on the federal level. But again, it's too little too late if it was ever anything that was going to cause a change. I know the NLRB is more pro-labor than it's been, I believe, since the 60s. But that doesn't mean much from a president that's willing to crush a massive transportation strike anyway. Yeah. You know, if he's willing to use the machinations of the federal government to inhibit labor, it doesn't matter how nice the NLRB is. It just doesn't seem structurally that anything is going anywhere near a positive direction.
No, it's just, we know these are both ruling class parties. Again, we're not saying anything new or unique right now on this podcast, but like, we just have to reinforce the notion that this system is in decline. It's in a spiral, and it doesn't matter which head of the two bourgeois parties is trying to guide it or maybe accelerating it into the abyss. But that's just where we're at. So just organize outside of these things. Nothing's coming, especially at the level of the presidency, out of these two parties to help us out of this.
Yeah, even thinking about the New Deal comparison, when FDR was brought in, he would talk to and tell movement leaders to push him in the right direction. And it seems like Joe Biden and the neoliberal Democrats are just annoyed and talking down to any movement that they're willing to even give an ear to. Like you said, they're constantly talking about how great the economy is. I mean, that's insane. It's not dealing with reality. It's not listening to the people. It's not caring about what anybody's interest is, even on the most basic level of politics. They've instead sort of doubled down on this idea that the people are stupid, that they don't understand that everything's working for them, that things are going to get better. They just need another 4 years, without showing anything to show for it.
Yeah.
And it's truly insane.
Yeah. And you've got the Dems saying that. And then, but again, the reality of the economy is that the Republicans can throw it, well, or the MAGA people could throw it right back in their face, right? Like, just as an example, I mentioned this to Nick, you know, my wife was talking to her parents who were pretty right, and she said that she had to go to Target and buy toilet paper, and it was like $41 for a pack of toilet paper, and her mother was just like, well, that's Bidenomics for you. So it's just like stupid arguments, like, between, again, as Nick said, two parties that nothing's going to change, but they both just have to make it look like they hate each other when really they are just the same thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And like, you can't blame people for being pissed off. It's just like when you're going to ascribe anything different to a Trump presidency, that's when you start to lose me a little bit. But Levi, you really touched on something that's been driving me especially crazy. And it's something that I've mentioned on the podcast before. It's just how fucking stupid they treat us. They treat us like infants when they talk to us, when they talk to us about the economy, and when they talk to us about Palestine. Like, Tony Blinken had the audacity to tweet something out about how it's been one of the most dangerous years in history for press officials. Like, it makes me want to lose my mind. Like, how do you have a war pig like that, how does he have the audacity and the gall to even think about making a statement like that when the policies he makes, the ideology that he supports, the bombs that he sends have killed 100 plus journalists in Gaza alone? Like, it's just like, when are people going to wake up to this? Like, and just be infuriated that they treat working class people like us with such utter disdain, as if we're the most ignorant little fucking beasts that you could imagine. Like, it infuriates me.
Yeah, I've been trying to come to grips with whether or not, because what strategy is that performance trying to lend credence to, right? Why are they saying these kinds of things? It was back on December 12th, Joe Biden said, without Israel, Jews wouldn't be safe anywhere.
Yeah, I meant to ask you how that made you feel.
It's terrifying.
Yeah.
This is the president of a country that has more Jews in it than any other nation on the planet. He's saying they wouldn't be safe here without a genocidal country representing them halfway around the world. The most dangerous place on earth for a Jew to be in right now is Israel. It's utterly insane that the president of the world's largest Jewish country is saying that Jews would not be safe here without Israel.
Yeah. That was wild. And they just have no idea. I mean, I don't think he does, but like, what makes you say that? And then to the point about being a make me do it president, like, we haven't had any kind of mass movement like we've had for Palestine, at least on the anti-war, anti-imperialist stage for a long time, you know? And I think you can make the case that, yeah, the BLM movements, just in terms of scale, definitely were on par with what's going on. And they paid lip service to it. They didn't do anything structurally, fundamentally about the police brutality issue. But I mean, you could argue that, at least rhetorically, it helped them win back, you know, helped them beat Trump along with COVID and everything like that. But like, again, they can't even respond to this mass movement, which, I mean, again, if you're talking about, can you be a make me do it president? And we're saying that, look, FDR, everything he did was a response to the movements on the ground, people demonstrating that, hey, we're going to withhold our support unless you do this. Like, in this moment, I don't think you could say that anything stronger. Again, we could wish for something stronger, but just with where the left is at right now, I mean, I think people are doing everything that they possibly can with the structures that are in place, and Biden doesn't want to fucking even acknowledge its existence.
Right, so how is Biden's response to the ceasefire movement, to the Palestinian movement in the United States, any different than Trump's response to the Black Lives Matter movement as it occurred?
Terrorist wreckers, right? That's what we are.
Or anti-Semites, all of us. I mean, the rhetoric is literally lifted from the same exact playbook of despising the people, of despising the movements. This isn't the make me do it president, it's the shut up, sit down. He has no interest in people taking to the streets or making demands on him. It's utter contempt. It's the same as Trump. I truly don't understand what the difference would be. I mean, if Trump were president now, the Democrats would maybe be giving lip service. I even wonder that.
Yeah, I don't think they would. Not with Israel. It's too entrenched with everything, with the both parties in this country, I think.
Steve, what are the right-wingers that you're listening to? Are they saying anything about Palestine and how the Biden administration is handling this, or are they even really acknowledging it?
Again, I think I mentioned before we started that I've taken a little bit of a break from some of that over the last week just to get some sanity back. But so, I mean, the main things that I've heard from them are, as Levi just kind of insinuated, like very much comparing the pro-Palestinian movement to BLM, in the sense of a lot of the right-wingers that I would listen to think like BLM and Antifa are terrorists and say that. And they also think like every single pro-Palestine march or activity is just an anti-Semitic one. So it's just effectively using, you know, the same language there. A lot of these people are like, they're on the face of things, they claim to be anti-intervention, especially Tim Pool. So he doesn't really think we should get involved, but he also thinks that like it's well within Israel's rights to just completely destroy Gaza and Palestine. The one time I was listening to him, and he put forth some stupid argument that like, I don't understand what Gaza's problem is. That he has this argument of like, well, they can just leave. And, you know, our conversation with Dan made it, you know, if for anyone who didn't know, very clear that that's not the case. And then his other argument is similar to one that Nick and I heard with a guy we know at the bar the other night, and is that like, why don't they just, because I think there was something tied up in the Abraham Accords where like they weren't involved at all, but they maybe could be given money or something. I forget exactly. You guys might know better than me.
I mean, the Abraham Accords was really just about the path to normalization between Israel and Saudi Arabia more than anything. And Levi, maybe you know more than I do, but that's how I understood it.
No, that's essentially all I gathered from it. It was a PR move by the state of Israel in order to get the leaders of various Arab states to support.
Right.
Well, the right have some argument that like Kushner put something in there that like Palestine could have gotten money if they just like acted like the good neighbor to Israel or something. And so they keep making these arguments that like, you know, it's just, well, why don't they just take money and live in a capitalist country and everything would be, you know, they could just survive and be affluent in their little tiny areas. And again, like complete disregard for the actual situation on the ground well prior to what's going on now. And, you know, what's been going on for the last 60 years. And there's always this argument that like, again, this goes to something else I was maybe going to mention. And I'm sure you guys have heard this from just like commentary in the news or whatever. It's like, we're ignorant. We don't know the history because we support Palestine. You know, we don't. And it's like their one point of history is like the Holocaust. And it's just like, you guys, you ignore the history of this and you don't know it. And it's like, well, I think we've done a little more research than you. And so, yeah, it's
we
like
we support Palestine because we know the history.
Right, exactly. And again, I think I mentioned on another podcast we did, you know, like Bill Maher always says, which I include in my right wing shitheads that I listen to. I include Bill Maher just by what he
definitely
would say.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You know, he always says, like, again, you ignore the history, you know, talking about and also, you know, the Holocaust effectively, and also by supporting Palestine, you're supporting Islam, and in his mind, or Muslims, and in his mind, that means you're supporting like people that just murder gay people or murder, you know, they're not liberal, or they don't have liberal values, that he says, and therefore, you know, you need to support Israel because otherwise we wouldn't have this liberal democracy in the Middle East, which again is, I think we all know what we feel about that.
Has Bill Maher been to America lately? Does he know that like you can't actually get married as a gay person in Israel? Like, what the fuck is he talking about?
It's hard to get into that guy's head. I mean, I really don't understand how he keeps getting more and more shows that appear to be pushing the same talking points he's had since what, the late 80s. I mean, the guy is a dinosaur even in his day.
Yeah,
I think maybe to pick up some of the threads, if there are any, that people like Tim Pool are talking about with the Abraham Accords, My guess is Tim Pool, like the other ethno-fascist Zionists, are thinking they probably don't even understand the concept of a Palestinian, and they're more confused by the fact that Egyptians, Jordanians, Syrians, or whatever were probably offered some sort of IMF loan or something to take control of the occupied territories or to accept Palestinians into their countries.
Yeah. Yeah, you're probably right. Again,
because they don't understand the difference between a Palestinian, an Egyptian, a Syrian, or a Jordanian. They're all Arabs to them. They can't comprehend why anybody would want to stay in their country.
Yep. And they're all Muslim extremists with no understanding of like the mosaic of religions and cultures within that whole region as it is anyway.
Yeah. And the only other thing I'll say about like the right, and again, I mentioned this to you guys, is, and it goes to that point of you don't know the history. It seems like almost every argument they have, and they criticize people for not knowing history or not studying, researching things. And it's like every point they have is some single person they heard a story on. Like one of them, you know, I think everybody knows how, you know, anti-trans all these people are. And so Tim Pool will have this one guy on the podcast, like, I don't know how many times he's been on. And he's a dad who, he claims his kids don't want to transition, but his wife was making them transition. And that the courts in California said that, like, listen, if your kids want to do this, you have to let them do it. And so he moved to Texas and, like, took his wife to court. And so he always has him on to say, like, you know, this is what the courts are doing. They just want everyone to transition, and they want, you know, they're just pushing the trans agenda. And so again, they take these one examples and use them as like, that's what is happening in the world. And again, it's one guy who's probably lying and probably lying about his kids. And is just some anti-trans dude who like hates his kids because they want to transition and just claims they don't. And it's all like, it's usually disgusting culture war issues like that, but it's also about, you know, general life in this country. They just, you know, criticize us for not knowing history, and then the other side of the, and then at the same time just have one random example of something, and therefore that is what the country is trying to do.
It's like that Charlie Kirk Turning Point USA meme. It's like, dear right wingers, you claim to hate identity politics. Curious. Because that's all that is, right? Like, that is just pure identitarianism based on like a single perspective. And I guess, you know, that fascist father is entitled to, I guess, his sick and twisted opinion. But again, just because it conforms to their narrative and their understanding, that's what they use to paint the entire experience with, right?
Yeah.
Talking about history, stop me if I mentioned this before, but I was working down at the casino and I saw this amazing t-shirt on a billboard-sized man. And there's no shortage of amazing t-shirts of people coming out of the casino. But anyway, the top of it, at the very top, it had in like script font, "We the people," of course. And then underneath it said, "Read it, learn it, love it, never change it." And then it had like a script date on the bottom of it, 1776. So "We the people" is not the first line of the document written in 1776. 1776 would be the Declaration of Independence. "We the people," I think, is referring to the Constitution, which was written in 1787, ratified in 1788, and not even put into operation until 1789. And it says, "Love it, learn it, never change it." It was immediately changed on 1791 when the Bill of Rights was introduced. Like, these t-shirts are incredible, but I think it encapsulates how the average chud thinks about these documents, that they are somehow immemorial, never changing, yet completely lack any understanding of the material conditions around everything that they claim to understand and read and learn and love. It's rare that one t-shirt encapsulates just so much indoctrination at once.
So many mental contradictions. What about the Articles of Confederation, brother?
Yeah, I don't think they'd be very happy with that one either.
Oh my god. But that's like states' rights shit, isn't it? We should go back to the Articles of Confederation, I think.
Well, the Articles of Confederation actually outlined the end of slavery, which was why it had to be reaffirmed in the Constitution as something that couldn't be changed for 10 years. Okay. So even the Articles of Confederation are a complicated, contradictory material process.
Well, of course, I'm just cheeky about. I don't even know if
anybody should ever read the Articles of Confederation. It's not really a document worth looking at too closely. It was not followed even in its day.
No. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I just don't know if like it's that person wearing that shirt. And again, this person is a representation, I think, of a lot of people would even like begin to like interrogate that history that is part of that whole time period between 1776 and when the actual Constitution was written and why these things might have come about. But to your point,
that whole document between the two and then the 13 to 18 other state constitutions that were written and redrafted between the two dates and the contradictory claims that are made within each state, between each state.
Yeah.
It's never that simple. It never has been and it never will be.
Know your history. Okay. You first. Oh, God. I don't know. But yeah, so that was, I guess, I mean, the right's kind of frustrating. I mean, obviously very frustrating. They haven't been as loud. Maybe it's just because I tune them out. It seems like they're relatively disorganized in this moment as well. I mean, I don't know if like Trump coming back along is going to embolden or revive it, but it seems like, you know, like that Moms for Liberty or whatever it is embroiled in scandal at this point in time. Ballot measures that have been spearheaded by a lot of these neo-fascist so-called grassroots organizations are being beaten by the people at the ballot. So, I mean, I guess there's some optimism on that front, but I think Trump probably has the potential to reinvigorate some of these movements. And it's always so funny to me because, you know, they scream about, you know, how beholden libs are to, you know, the Democratic Party and everything, but they cannot extricate their own fortunes from the ballot box either. So they're just as cucky liberals as the rest of them.
Well, they're all going to galvanize under this. You know, I think just before we started, I saw a headline that Maine has now said that Trump can't be on the ballot. So now there's two states. They're going to galvanize behind this as well. They'll lose their shit over this.
Yeah. I mean, but is it really going to draw new interest or are these just going to be the same people that were already?
Yeah, it'll be the
mad?
Same people, but they'll get louder again. Maybe not galvanized, but they'll become louder again, I think, because of this.
I think what's kind of interesting, and maybe to segue us, the U.S. Steel sale to Nippon, is it Nippon or Nippon?
Nippon.
It's actually caused some rift within the Republican Party because they have those faux labor populists that are coming out and claiming that this is bad for American industry and bad for American jobs and bad
for
the working class. The neo-Republican John Fetterman. But you even get people like J.D. Vance coming out with John Fetterman and Sherrod Brown claiming that this is bad for American workers. And I mean, there's complete lack of coercion or cohesion in their articulation because they have no shared sympathy with the labor movement as it exists or the union movement as it wants to emerge. But they also have this faux populist rhetoric that they want to maintain and position themselves as for the working class that, you know, where are these two things going to meet? At least when Fetterman and Casey come out, they claim it's for union positions. Whereas J.D. Vance is just claiming it's for some amorphous, non-existent, hard hat worker that wants to work without being paid.
Well, and it's because it's U.S. steel, buddy. Right? It's not Japan steel.
I guess that's it. It's that it's like some sort of defense position that we need to have these plants in America because this is where the steel needs to be made.
Yeah, but like no steel's made here anymore. It's all made in Japan or Korea or Europe. Basically, I know they claimed it came back under Trump, and I think some came back, but this is, you know, the majority of the world's steel is made in Asia and in, you know, China just built a massive plant in Indonesia, and that is it's a huge percentage of the world's steel production using Chinese ore to make steel in Indonesia.
Well, most of the steel production in the U.S. right now, so you have to understand that U.S. steel is one of the few remaining places in America that does like primary steel production through like the basic oxygen furnace process. And I'm not going to get into what that means or whatever, but there is still steel production in the US where most of it comes from is through recycling. So they take
using scrap,
steel scrap, and remelt that to produce essentially new steel stock. US steel is a basic oxygen, like primary kind of process. Anyway, that's really neither here nor there. Going back to like the protectionism thing, I think Trump did invoke like a national security type of statute to help try to quote unquote protect some of the steel industry here under the guise of like, well, we need production of this material for the defense industry, for again, national security. And again, I think infrastructure gets tied to that as well, where, look, we do need some kind of steel production process here. And you know what? Like, on its face, especially like the defense stuff aside, because it's all offense here, but like from an infrastructural perspective, yeah, like that does make a lot of sense, especially even in the context of like, okay, if we're looking towards the environmental aspect of this, shipping steel halfway across the globe doesn't make a lot of sense on that front either. You know, again, but like my problem with this whole conversation, and I'm sure you guys will agree, is that this conversation is all taking place within the capitalist context without imagining any kind of alternatives at all. Because in a socialist future, we should absolutely still have local home manufacturing capability with an eye towards making a better, cleaner, greener world. But like all of these decisions get made purely on the profit motive. And that's what these guys like J.D. Vance aren't, and even Fetterman for that matter, aren't going to talk about or bring into this conversation at all. Nippon Steel buying U.S. steel is the free market at work, baby. That's what it is.
Yeah.
So like on one side of his mouth, J.D. Vance will talk about the glories, the perfection of capitalism. And on the other, he'll talk about we need to save our domestic workforce. It's like, how are you going to do that, dude? I mean, I guess maybe through like national socialism.
Yeah. But I mean, J.D. Vance, and you both kind of insinuated this, it's just lip service with him. You know, he doesn't give a shit.
Absolutely.
He does not care about workers. He does not care about local jobs. He just knows that that'll appeal to this base that the Republicans have been able to create because the Democrats have abandoned the working class for so many years that the Republicans have been able to at least talk to them. And again, it's all lip service, but at least they talk to them.
Yeah, you have a letter coming out from Josh Hawley, J.D. Vance, and Marco Rubio, you know, big friends of labor that they are.
Yeah.
And they conclude, trade protections can and should induce foreign investment that expands domestic production and creates American jobs. This corporate takeover is out of step with these goals. Allowing foreign companies to buy out American companies and enjoy our trade protections subverts the very purpose for which those protections were put in place. But I think, Nick, to your point, that's just capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
They found out that they could act like an American company and get all the trade benefits and tax benefits by just buying an American company. The shareholders are the same. It's just now has a P.O. box in Japan instead of a P.O. box in Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
And I think to your other point, Public Source actually did a really good article on this entitled, Public Source being the local independent research based news source in Pittsburgh, U.S. Steel's acquisition will end a difficult marriage that forged and constrained Pittsburgh's identity. And I just want to read this one paragraph to talk about alternatives. The corporation vigorously opposed attempts, corporation being U.S. Steel, by employees to acquire plants and continue production as employee-owned firms, as steel workers at nearby Weirton Steel were able to do in 1984. Laid-off workers at U.S. Steel's Duquesne Works went so far as to set up round-the-clock sentries at the plant to keep the corporation from taking vital equipment away from the site. Saving jobs or preserving the communities that had literally been built around its steel plants were never a corporate priority. So I don't want to hear any of these senators or hear anybody opine about the U.S. steel industry as having any interest whatsoever in Americans, workers, communities, individuals, the city of Pittsburgh. They could not care less. When they announced the deal was being sold, they said that it was going to be a boon to their shareholders. That is all they care about.
What do these people think happened in the fucking 70s and the 80s? Well, really the 80s more than anything. When all of these towns around here that were built around, you know, not even like necessarily like a full steel plant, but again, like a refining process, maybe like a special metals treatment plant or like coke production or whatever it may be. They just moved the production elsewhere because it was cheaper to do so. And when they moved it out just to get cheaper labor costs, they left these communities behind. Mm-hmm. Okay. And they're still operating under the same fucking ideology now, to your point, Levi. And I think that encapsulates that all very well. It's about what the shareholders want. So I don't want to hear anything from these fucking imbeciles.
And it was the same in England under Thatcher, when she closed the shipyards and the mines and everywhere else that these cities and towns were and villages were just completely built around this industry, and you shut them down and there's nothing there. And these places, you know, you drive through central Pennsylvania and you drive through some parts of England and there's still no recovery in these areas. The people and the workers are just left to, you know, just get more and more desperate.
Right. And then you get something like the IRA being passed, which claims that everything for the new construction has to be domestically sourced. So they're going to get it from U.S. Steel, owned by a Japanese company, employed by God knows who, God knows where. There is no such thing as an American company as long as it's owned by an international conglomerate of shareholders. They don't have any interest in the community, the country, the nation, anything. Their interest is purely profit. And they'll do anything.
Yeah. I mean, just because I was getting onto themes of, I think, green capitalism a little bit, I didn't articulate it very well, right? But like, there's all these different arguments that you could make that are like, oh, well, we shouldn't be producing steel here anyway. But again, you have to think about the jobs and the livelihoods that you're taking away from people. And I don't even agree with that. I still think that we probably need some level of steel production. We need to invest in ways to clean it up, absolutely, you know, and look to the future for how we, you know, build infrastructure in a cleaner way and everything. But again, we're not living there right now. And again, I'm not arguing for some kind of like just transition or anything like that. It's just that like the profit motive doesn't take into account everything from environmental impact in terms of, you know, your production inputs to the shipping costs and the environmental impact of shipping like steel beams across oceans, mm-hmm. to again, the communities that get left behind when a plant just ups and leaves to save a couple extra bucks an hour per worker. It just doesn't take that into account. And then we hear about, okay, well, we're going to address some of these things that you're talking about, Nick, with green capitalism, right? We're going to convert over to, you know, electric cars and all this kind of shit. And then that leads us to situations like what's going on in the Congo right now. And I don't want to spend a ton of time on this because we don't have a ton of time tonight. But, you know, we're talking obviously about the genocide in Gaza, and we should be, but we cannot forget what's going on in the Congo right now. I think 6 million people have died in the Congo through various, you know, political wars that are ongoing over there since 1996. Okay. And a lot of it revolves around controlling interests in the resource mines that exist in this nation, because this is a resource-rich nation. Cobalt is one of the key inputs into the batteries that go into your cell phone or the electronics that go into your cell phone, right? You know, we hear a lot about lithium and shit.
Tantalum as well. There's tons of tantalum in, like every cell phone has tantalum, and there's a lot in the Congo.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, we've got a situation where, you know, there's these capitalist-funded factions vying for control and operation of these mines. We've got six-year-olds working in the mines here. We're talking about cell phones that, you know, are designed to die after every 2 years. So, like, this supply chain is constantly needed to be reinvigorated, and it needs to be constantly flowing. And we're going to see this in the lithium mines, wherever we need for our electric cars and our fucking green capitalism. That, you know, everything's going to be designed to die after a few years so we can reinvest and buy again. That's what green capitalism is going to lead to.
I mean, it's green capitalism, but it's still dependent on sort of this anarchy of the market.
Absolutely.
The production is key because it's always going to be cheaper to have enslaved people mine it than it would be to pay people to recycle it correctly.
Yep.
Like, there's no plan. And anytime there is anything like a patchwork of, you know, green legislation or initiatives, as you were saying, it's either just going to make it so that they move it somewhere else where you don't see it. So you just transport these steel beams across the planet, or they use these, you know, pitiful green legislation in order to justify that they can be moved to locations around the planet that aren't regulated whatsoever, as though they had any hesitation to begin with in doing so. I mean, these companies hire more PR firms than anything. I mean, that seems to be their largest line item.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think about a company like Shell. You go on their website, they talk about our goal to be carbon neutral by 2050. How the fuck are you going to be carbon neutral? You produce fucking gas. What are you talking about?
They're going to plant trees, bro.
Or even more nefarious are these rare earth mineral miners that claim that they guarantee that there's no slavery or child labor.
Yeah.
But they instead just use contractors that, you know, pinky swear they're not using child labor or slavery. But, you know, look out the window and you see a 6-year-old starving, pulling through bits of metal.
Yep. Yes.
There's no protections whatsoever when it's left to the corporate self-regulation.
Right. And that's like what I get back to when we're talking about the impact of U.S. steel and like where we go from here. Any kind of analysis that you see come up is just at this point in my mind, look, we do have to still contend with the reality that exists, but we have to start imagining something different at this point in time. Like, I mean, we've seen this story play out so many times in so many different ways, all with the same result. It's like, at what point are we going to start demanding the imagination, the creation of a new, better, more humane fucking future?
To kind of go back to that Congo mess, you know, that example you had, you know, the interesting thing about that is whenever you get like a more left government in any of these areas, right, you'll start seeing things like, well, we can't buy from the Congo because it's a conflict mineral, or they'll make up some bullshit that like will try and force some type of regime change in that area to get a more brutal dictator or something there that will be advantageous for Western capital, but terrible for the people of that country, which leads to, as you said, 6 million people dead over how many years? But so it's all capitalism pushes all this shit. Yeah, exactly. Get a new iPhone, get whatever consumer shit you want, but it just absolutely decimates these countries, what capital does to them and what our capitalism does to them.
Why it rings so hollow when you hear these fucking assholes screaming about national sovereignty with U.S. steel.
Yeah.
But national sovereignty doesn't matter to anybody else. That doesn't count in the Congo.
No, because that's not a settler country. Who are we supposed to side with?
Yeah, I guess the people that bring civilization, right?
U.S. steel.
I don't know. Yeah. So, capitalism, imperialism, gotta die. We're getting close to an hour here, so Levi, I do want to turn back to Palestine before we wrap up. I know you had something on what's going on with some, I guess, refuseniks in the IOF. So maybe we can do that as we start to close, and then we'll talk about kind of like a year in review thing, and we'll wrap.
I'll try to work through this as quickly as possible. Yeah, December 27th is officially the first date that somebody refused to go into the IOF, which is a mandatory position for every individual of sound mind and body in the state of Israel.
So the first time in history?
No, the first time since October 7th. Mm. No, it's happened various times throughout Israeli history.
I mean, I figured, I just wanted to clarify.
Oh, yeah. The title of the article in Haaretz is First Israeli Conscientious Objector of the Gaza War is Jailed, quote, I Know It's the Right Thing, by Linda Diane, December 27th, 2023. Quote, It's not an easy time, said one person who had come to see him off over the din of cheers for Mitnick. My friend is going to jail. The teenager addressed his supporters before entering the base, quote, I'm standing here at the Tel Hasharam base and refusing to be drafted, refusing to take part in the war in Gaza. I believe the slaughter does not solve slaughter. Violence does not solve violence. From there, He would enter the draft office and express his refusal to serve. He was then sentenced to a preliminary 30 days in military prison, which is 3 times as long as a normal first sentence for draft refusal. In a month's time, he will face the choice of either drafting or receiving another jail sentence. And I think it's actually worth going to this interview that he gave to 972 Magazine back in September 5th. This was back during the protests in Israel, let's say, that galvanized him. So this is Tal Mitnick, back when he was 17. I and other youths realized that the dictatorship that exists in Israel, the dictatorship that existed for decades in the occupied territories, are inseparable. The great goal of the politicians and the settlers is to deepen the occupation and the oppression of more populations inside Israel and in the occupied territories, and to annex Area C of the West Bank, which is under full Israeli military control. For many of us, these demonstrations were an awakening. I was not politically active before the protests. They made me understand what it means to demonstrate as a draftee with hundreds of others before their enlistment and to say, quote, "We will not serve." So think of that, what he actually stated, as we return to Haaretz to see how they actually frame this. Then came October 7th, and Hamas's, quote, "brutal massacre and abduction of Israeli mobilized the nation. Dissenting reservists immediately returned to duty, and protest groups shifted to aiding displacement residents and soldiers in need." However, Hamas's incursion did not change Mitnick's mind. Quote, "Since the start of the war, my resolve has only gotten stronger," he said. "The terrorist attack of October 7th was a horrible, illegitimate form of resistance that harmed the whole country. The pain reached every household, and it was kind of showed how you really can't have an occupation and a siege 20 miles, 12 kilometers, from your home and not feel it," end quote.
I mean, that last part I definitely agree with. I just, maybe as he gets older, he'll realize the connection there, you know, that like it is a legitimate form of resistance when you're under siege. But, you know, at least he's making the connection there that like, look, you know, it's kind of understandable that these people would do that. I don't, you know, I don't think it's legitimate or anything, which is again the part where he loses me. But like, at least he's acknowledging that like there's persecution and oppression.
What's interesting is his words were actually quoted a little bit differently in more sympathetic journals.
Mm-hmm.
So 972, I guess, followed up with him on December 28th today. In an article entitled, "I Refuse to Take Part in a Revenge War, Israel Jails Teen for Opposing Army Drafts." And it states explicitly, Tal Mitnick is the first Israeli conscientious objector to be imprisoned since October 7th. He explains why the current war has only reaffirmed his convictions. In a message that sharply diverges from the mainstream Israeli public discourse amid the army's ongoing assault on Gaza, and at the time when anyone in Israel who expresses even mild opposition to the war is facing persecution and repression, Mitnick told 972, quote, "My refusal is an attempt to influence Israeli society and to avoid taking part in the occupation and the massacre happening in Gaza. I'm trying to say that it's not in my name. I express solidarity with the innocents in Gaza. I know they want to live. They don't deserve to be made refugees for the second time in their lives," end quote. In a statement of refusal published ahead of his incarceration, Mitnick described the Hamas-led October 7th attack on southern Israel as, quote, "a trauma unlike any other in the history of the country," but asserted that the army's bombardment of Gaza is not the answer. Quote, "There is no military solution to a political problem," he wrote. "Therefore, I refuse to enlist in an army that believes that the real problem can be ignored under a government that only continues the bereavement and pain. I refuse to believe that more violence will bring security," he continued. "I refuse to take part in a revenge war." Shortly before entering prison, Mitnick spoke to 972 about his decision to refuse, the fear of entering prison in the current political climate, and the message he aims to convey to the public in Israel and Gaza. So I'm only going to go over two of the questions that were asked by Oren, but I think they're pretty interesting, because I think they shed some light that's not being covered particularly well. After October 7th, this is Oren's question. After October 7th, many who were on the left claimed they sobered up. Did this affect you? Then Mitnick's response, There is no justification for harming innocent civilians. The criminal attack on October 7th, in which innocents were killed, is illegitimate resistance to the opposition of the Palestinian people, in my eyes. However, outlawing legitimate resistance, such as protests or declaring human rights organizations as terrorist organizations, leads people to dehumanize the other and to actions targeting civilians. October 7th did not change my position. It only reinforced it. I still believe it is impossible to live with the siege on Gaza and an occupation and not feel any consequences. I believe that many people finally understand this. The idea of out of sight, out of mind doesn't work. Something needs to change, and the only way is to talk, to reach a political settlement. I'm not saying it will solve everything, but it will be another step towards justice and peace. And I thought this was just a fun answer that he gave. So Oren asks, how do you plan to pass the time in prison? I have a few long books, which I hope they will allow me to bring in. Drinking the Sea at Gaza by Amir Haas, A History of the CIA, and A History of the Mizrahi Struggle by Sami Shalom. I just think it's interesting that he's going to be reading up on the American CIA while he's in Israeli prison. Seems like he's starting to see the bigger picture here.
Yeah, maybe he'll get even more radicalized as he's got some time to read in prison.
Yeah, I can't imagine he wouldn't. In this little piece, I think just to summarize all of this from Al Jazeera on their piece, Who Are the Israeli Refuseniks Picking Jail Over the Gaza War? December 27th, 2023. And it says, what does the law say? The right to conscientious objection to military service is protected by international law enshrined in Article 18 of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. The UN Commission for Human Rights has stated that states must, quote, refrain from subjecting conscientious objectors to imprisonment and to repeated punishment for failure to perform military service. However, this is a common practice in Israel, not only to imprison objectors, but to repeat sentences several times.
So that's the surprise of the century to me, buddy.
Yeah. He's going in there having already, I believe, served 30 days detention, and he's expecting to serve multiple terms in jail for his refusal, for his conscientious objection status. Just to put that little cherry on top, that Israel has no interest in treating its own population by the stipulations of the UN when it's not convenient for their aims.
What's one more UN rights abuse?
But seriously. But I think that speaks to imagining a better world. I mean, this kid, literally a kid, is going to jail because he's imagining that the world could be better and that his time would be better spent off the front lines, that he would literally be doing better work for humanity sitting in a jail cell than he would be holding a gun.
Yeah, and you just wish there were more of them, you know? And I think a lot of people are going to be like, oh, well, you know, don't lionize this one, you know, Zionist or whatever. And look, this kind of story, it's great. It's amazing. And we need a lot more of it. And I don't even want to put this kid on like a pedestal above, because I think the fear is that like this kid gets put on a pedestal like above the Palestinian resistance, right? To say, hey, look, like, let's look to like the decent Zionists, right? You know? So I think there's a trap of that, which I mean, I don't think we're doing. But I think it is, you have to put this kid in his own context as well, where like, I'm assuming that as an 17, 18 year old, he was probably born in Israel, came up through the whole system, and is still able to recognize at least some of the systemic problems. And again, 17, 18 years old, there's a lot of hope that he's going to get better as he goes on. You know, he's just a kid, he's growing up, he's dealing with his own baggage and everything. So I'm not going to damn this kid. I know already I picked on a couple things he said already. That's just critiquing little statements. But like, again, the kid's in a better spot than I was at friggin' 17 or 18 years old. You know what I mean? In terms of political ideology. So there's always hope to improve. I think just some of the pushback people would get on this, like on like a face value thing, is like, hey, you know, like this kid is not more of a hero than every facet of the resistance at this point in time. But hopefully this could, you know, spark more. Because that's what you need. You need people in Israel saying, like, I mean, it's part of what you need. It's not entirely what you need. But it would be a huge step to have more people in Israel doing this and saying, hey, look, we need to get to a political solution here. Because again, as we've talked about in the podcast before, the only military solution to this is genocide, which isn't a solution at all.
Now, and I guess not to lionize him, but I certainly was not at that place either. I don't think I'd be willing to spend a day in prison when I was 18, much less looking at indefinite imprisonment, which is essentially what he's staring down right now. Well, I'm sure he's being treated far away above better than any of the Palestinians coming out of Gaza being abducted and put into Israeli prisons. I can't imagine it's going to be a cakewalk either.
Oh, agreed.
And being labeled an anti-Semite in America hurts your chances. I mean, can you imagine his chances in Israel after this point? Like, unless the society changes in a dramatic way, he's making a lot of very big decisions right now.
And don't get me wrong, I'm not saying he shouldn't be commended.
Yeah.
I'm just saying the narrative shouldn't be carried to the point where it like focuses on this one Israeli.
Of course.
Is there a sense out of this for like how many other people are perhaps supportive of his decision?
So it depends on who you're reading, because he's the first one that's actually been brought up before the trial, like the board that decides who goes to prison and who just gets accepted as a conscientious objector with legitimate means. And it sounds like it's really easy to actually get a legitimate claim of not being able to go to the front line. And it sounds like there's a lot of those coming through, people that don't want to support the war but are not willing to stand as actually principled conscientious objectors. And I believe that letter that's mentioned in the 972 magazine, because that first interview of him when he's a 17-year-old, is from a letter of over 250 children signing that they will do what he just did if ever asked to serve. It's just that his was the first name that has come up and didn't have an obvious, you know, physical ailment or objection that wouldn't allow him to serve. Because other people have gone before and said that they won't serve, but they also found out that they were like colorblind
mm-hmm.
or claimed to be religious, or because there's lots of ways to get out of serving in Israel, which is no surprise either. But it's mostly the minority ethnicities, not the Ashkenazi ethnicities that serve.
I mean, I got to imagine there's some less principled refuseniks as well, though. I mean, people that just don't want to go and get fucking ventilated by a Hamas resistance fighter.
Right. And a lot of those people, I guess, it's really easy to game their system and just get a position, I don't know, working at a mall for the IDF because they have people with guns walking around the whole country.
Right. Right. Well, I mean, hopefully that kind of spirit takes off a little more and just sharpens the contradictions that have to exist within the state.
Yeah. And when we were going over those protests, it was always a minority, but there was always a small contingent that made that connection directly with the vitality of the anti-occupation movement with the anti-state movement, the way that these kids have. And if that can become a sort of marker that wakes people up, then all for it. And whatever gets people interested in learning more and just being involved is a positive. Even if it's just being anti-Trump, being anti-Netanyahu, if it gets you to think twice and look harder at what you're actually learning, it's a good step.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I guess we'll see how that develops. In the meantime, you know, we obviously have our hands full at home here because, as we talked about off top, Biden's rhetoric, Blinken's rhetoric, it's not changing. And the shipments aren't changing. There's still a ton of weapons going over. Luckily, it seems like this half-assed coalition against Ansar Allah, it's kind of falling apart. I don't think the French and Canada are sending whatever little contingent that they had planned to send to begin with anymore. Saudi Arabia is, I think, at this point, refusing to re-engage in a war with Yemen. So, you know, hopefully they can continue to kind of do the work that's far and above what anybody else is doing. But we have to keep at it here, keep putting on the pressure, keep giving hope and building our movement here. I mean, again, I've always said that the best thing that we can do in the U.S. is build a strong anti-imperialist left that can actually make these demands and work towards a new society that wouldn't send fucking weapons to Israel for genocide.
Yeah.
But that's a process. It's not going to happen overnight. You know, we can wish it into existence, and it's not going to do us or the Palestinians any good at all, it's going to take legwork and elbow grease. I'm going to sound a little bit like a boomer here, but again, you're going to have to put in some time and work to actually achieve that.
And don't let Nikki Haley distract you by talking about the Civil War.
Yeah, it's just, you know, it's been pissing me off lately, though, like some of the discourse on like Twitter and shit. And again, it's probably a reason not to be on Twitter too much, but I do think it infects the real world to some extent as well, of just like sitting back and fucking critiquing every organization. And if you go out and organize and you have your critique of an organization, I'm more likely to listen to you. But if you're just sitting on Twitter and complaining about, oh, I heard this really bad thing, nobody should ever work with them again. I mean, you need to grow up. You need to grow up. You need to get a grip on fucking reality. Because nothing is ever going to be perfect. Nothing is utopian. We don't live in a perfect world, and we have a very weak left right now. So, you know, if you're going to make critiques and shit, at least go out on the streets and work with people and back your shit up.
Mm-hmm.
Outside of some hearsay on some obscure little fucking Instagram account or Twitter account or X account or whatever the fuck it is now.
Get off Twitter, man. It's pretty awesome not being on.
You talking to me or? Because I don't even go on Twitter that much, but
social media is just a fucking, I don't know. It's terrible. I think there's obviously advantages to social media, but at the same time, you can just go, if you let it consume you, and you can just, I don't know. It can be detrimental, I think.
Yeah. There was somebody talking about the new J. Edgar Hoover biography, which, you know, whatever it is. And in this biography, they were talking about the machinations of COINTELPRO. And I guess one of the biggest things that they harped on, and they didn't make the connection, but I think it's easy enough to connect to social media, that a lot of the informants in these leftist groups across America were given instruction by the FBI to spread false information about infighting and what was said by other people in order to destroy these groups. But half the time, what would come back is a letter saying that the group had already dissolved due to its own infighting. That most of the time, the left needs no help in infighting and destroying itself.
Yeah.
And I think social media has just turned that up to 11.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, people are quick to point out feds. Like, I don't think a lot. I mean, there's no way the government feels the need at this point to invest in all of these people that are acting as basically wreckers on social media, because there's too many. There's way too many. Like, and I mean it seriously. I know it's a little bit mean before, but like, I really do think that if you're going to sit around and critique, like, at least come from a basis of like, okay, I've got the experience to do it. You'll sound more credible.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if nothing else, you know?
Yeah. And organizing on the left has never been easy, but it's always been extremely important.
Yeah.
The only good things that have ever come out of this country have come from. That's why they need constant fights on the federal level to crush the left, is because they know it's the only place of actual mechanical structural change that could arise in this country.
But one thing I want to actually like double down on, I guess, to not countervene, but reinforce my point of actually going out and doing it, is that in my experience, it's been almost cathartic on like, and again, I don't want to distill this all down to like a personal level and your personal feelings, but actually getting out and engaging and talking with like-minded people and organizing with them and like pulling off a successful event is extremely satisfying on a personal level. Even if you're just going to distill it down to that aspect, which you shouldn't, you know, but I think you're going to get actually more of an endorphin hit if you actually go out and do the real actual work, you know, than anything that you can get from a few likes on Twitter or Instagram or anything like that.
Yeah. There's lots of people out there that would be incredibly welcoming.
Yeah.
It's not that hard to find places to be.
No. Anyway, I'll get off my little half-drunk soapbox.
That's all this is.
Yeah. You boys got anything else? You want to get on the soapbox while I get off at all?
No, I'm good.
Yeah, I think I already spoke my piece.
Okay.
The new year, we need to think of new solutions. Don't be defeated. just keep fighting.
Yeah. This is the most important election of your life in the sense that you need to be working towards building a new alternative.
Right. Maybe the election's not that important, but this is one of the most important political moments.
It's a political moment. Absolutely. So my New Year's, my hope for the New Year's is that we double the size of the organized left on the ground. And I think we're on our way to doing that. So
go from 8 to 16 people.
Exactly. Yeah. And then we'll just, you know, have an exponential growth effect.
Here's hoping.
Anyway, as always, thank you guys for listening. As we've harped on, go out and get organized. We've got some exciting stuff in the pipe for you guys. More PZE. I know Levi's got about 3 episodes just ready for us to fire here. I'm going to take a stab at a theory episode, taking some inspiration from Professor Levi. That should be coming shortly. Steve, I know, is working hard on the intro to the IRA series that we've been promising, and I think that'll fit really nicely into this whole conversation as well, given the history of solidarity between Ireland and Palestine. We'll eventually get back to Marx, although I think, again, chapter 15 of Marx, just while it's still important, has taken a backseat to some, maybe some other more important things at the moment. But we'll get back to it eventually. We're here for a while. So again, thanks for listening. We'll catch y'all next time. Free Palestine.
Adios, paisanos.